The Guardian.
The Guardian Books Podcast with Claire Armistead.
The Guardian has partnered with audible.co.uk to offer listeners a free audiobook if you sign up for a two-week trial of their service. Audible has 40,000 titles available to download. For all the details, follow the links at guardian.co.uk/audible.
Three respectable London druggists in widely remote quarters of London, from whom I happened lately to be purchasing small quantities of opium, assured me that the number of amateur opium eaters was immense. This evidence respected London only. But some years ago, on passing through Manchester, I was informed by several cotton manufacturers that their workpeople were rapidly getting into the practice of opium eating. So much so that on a Saturday afternoon, the counters of the druggists were strewed with pills of 1, 2, or 3 grains in preparation for the known demand of the evening. The immediate occasion of this practice was the lowness of wages, which at that time would not allow them to indulge in ale or spirits, and wages rising, it may be thought that this practice would cease. But as I do not readily believe that any man, having once tasted the divine luxuries of opium, will afterwards descend to the gross and mortal enjoyments of alcohol, I take it for granted that those eat now who never ate before, and those who always ate now eat the more.
Despite the wonders of human consciousness, Huxley believed that our brains have been trained during the evolutionary millennia to screen out all those perceptions that do not directly aid us in our day-to-day struggle for existence. We've gained security and survival, but in the process have sacrificed our sense of wonder. After his LSD trips, the shutters around his mind at last fell away, revealing the wonders of existence to his self-centered and earthbound mind.
So, you think you know where madness lies?
My answer was a convinced and heartfelt yes.
And you couldn't control it?
No, I couldn't control it. If one began with fear and hate as the major premise, one would have to go on to the conclusion.
Would you be able, my wife asked, to fix your attention on what the Tibetan Book of the Dead calls the clear light?
I was doubtful.
Would it keep the evil away if you could hold it? Or would you not be able to hold it?
I considered the question for some time. Perhaps, I answered at last, perhaps I could, but only if there was someone there to tell me about the clear light. One couldn't do it by oneself. That's the point, I suppose, of the Tibetan ritual. Someone sitting there all the time and telling you what's what.
What was the fucking point of shooting coke if he wasn't going to get a proper rush? It was intolerable.
Indignant and yet anxious about the consequences, Patrick took out the second syringe, sat down on the loo again and rolled up his sleeve. The strange thing was that the rush seemed to be getting stronger, as if it had been dammed up against his shirt sleeve and had taken unusually long to reach his brain. In any case, he was now committed to a second fix.
And even with a combination of bowel movement, excitement, and dread,
he tried to put the spike back in exactly the same
I had to eat every day,
or I'd be hungry.
That was before heroin.
I am drugged.
I get more rest now than I ever have.
My back never felt better.
Monday is the new Friday.
And Friday night is like having Sunday morning come early.
I used to cringe at the doctors when they would draw blood. That doesn't happen anymore.
Who needs doc? Heroin is my hero.
Oh, just, subtle, and mighty opium. That to the hearts of poor and rich alike, for the wounds that will never heal, and for the pangs that tempt the spirit to rebel, bringest an assuaging balm. Eloquent opium.
For you, a
I got nerve. Can you put them pills on my bill? Yo, I'll tell you with friends, and yo, we don't even chill. I need drugs.
His eyes tightly closed, while a rapid succession of scenes flashed across his inner vision.
Thou buildest upon the bosom of darkness, out of the fantastic imagery of the brain, cities and temples beyond the art of Phidias and Praxiteles. Beyond the
a bee crashing drunkenly into the pollen-laden pistils of a flower. Fissures spreading over the concrete of a disintegrating dam. A long blade cutting strips of flesh from the body of a dead whale. A barrel of gouged-out eyes tumbling stickily between the cylinders of a wine press.
And thou hast the keys of paradise, O just, subtle, and mighty opium.
Well, that was enough to make even the most sober among us feel a bit woozy. The writing life has always been an intoxicating business, and there's no denying that narcotics have played their part. Nevertheless, it was something of a surprise to read in Jeet Thayil's new novel Narcopolis that intellectual life in Bombay, Mumbai, is quite so dominated by the use of drugs. First, let's hear Jeet read a passage from the novel.
Rashid walked back to the khana with the bundle of vials and the bottles of Johnny Walker in his hands. He was calmer now. Even the heat seemed milder, the sun directly overhead but not uncomfortable, and the noise in his head had settled into a hum, steady and controlled, like paper burning in a tray. His white shirt lay open to the sternum and his pants were hitched low on his belly. He wore only white. He spotted the color on the mannequins in store windows and people on the street, and to him, the figures in white were as distinctive as angels among the earthbound. He was thinking of Salim's line, "Are you a man or a pajama?" He wanted more options than just the two. His father said they were descended from the Mughals, from a Beg who had ridden with Humayun. There was a branch of the family in Delhi that had owned 16th-century buildings and gardens. It was a family legend that he mistrusted, but every now and then he would catch himself thinking of the Mughals and the majun they liked to eat, swallowed with a glass of milk like medicine, and he'd see himself as a new Mughal, mixing it up, juggling the booze with the coke and charas and chandu. This morning, he was planning to take it easy. He'd keep the whiskey down to manageable quantities, a half bottle, no more, and then the rest of it would be manageable too. Line of white, first thing to get his eyes open. Piali of black at regular intervals to keep his nerves easy and his ideas oiled. And, around the time the muezzin sent out the evening call, a bit of brown chased on foil or smoked in a cigarette, the powder cake so heavy the joint would have to be lit and relit. This is the new thing. Brown powder, Gharad heroin with the compliments of the Pakistani government, something sweet for the mouth from our Muslim brothers. The question being, what kind of government would see anything in heroin but poison? Which god would welcome such a drug? Not the Hindu god, and not even the god of the Christians. So what did it mean that the Pakistanis, who worshipped the same god as he, were sending Gharad to India? It meant that politics or economics overrode every other thing in the world. They shared the same faith, but in other ways they were enemies.
Thank you very much. Now, that's Rashid, who's one of the central characters who we meet at the beginning of the book as the owner of an opium house.
Yeah.
Then he goes the way of the city, as we've seen in that reading. Tell us a little bit about the setup of this novel.
It opens in the late 70s when there was a street in Bombay called Shuklaji Street, which is where much of the novel is based, which had about 40 opium dens of various sizes. Including tiny ones that had one pipe and large ones with three or four pipes. And Rashid's was an actual den in Shuklaji Street. I think it closed around 1984, and which was famous among the hippies of the time. Everybody knew about it. It had tourists. And then, of course, heroin arrived. And all the people who had spent years, and we're talking about men with families and businesses who had a small sort of very manageable opium habit and would smoke a pipe a day in a very gracious and beautiful old world way, you know, because a pipe is something that takes a long time to make, an opium pipe. It's not like heroin, which is quick and cheap and ugly. It's a beautiful, graceful thing. And all of that stopped, all of that ended, all of that changed. Heroin came in. All the people were smoking opium and living healthy, productive, fairly productive, responsible lives with businesses and families turned to heroin, and most of them died very quickly. And all of it changed because heroin was so much cheaper and stronger, and I think in many ways changed the character of the entire area as well, and eventually, of course, the city.
Tell us a little bit about the relationship between your fiction and documentary, because you're talking as if it's a book about a period of history.
Well, I was a journalist. That was my job for many years. I was a journalist for about 20 years in New York, Hong Kong, Bombay, and especially in Bombay for many years. And I was also a smoker of opium and a user of heroin, and eventually went into rehab and all of that. I didn't know at the time that I would write a novel about it, and I never thought about it as research. It was a compulsion and a habit and something that I loathed myself about, as most people do. But of course, eventually, what I realized was happening at that time, I prefer to look at it that way because it makes me feel better today. It was a kind of embedded journalistic research.
But this is not a journalistic novel. I think it's quite interesting. We've had a few novels this year, some of which we've featured on this podcast, which do seem to be journalism put into novels. This is very woozy. You don't foreground political reality.
No, I'm glad you say that. I chanced upon the form about a year into working on the book. The opening sentence, a long 6.5-page sentence, was written about a year and a half after I'd begun to work on the book. And then I realized, of course, this is the form of the novel because it's a novel about opium. And so the sentences should be long, very long, and dreamy and open-ended. And it shouldn't be the short, declarative, Hemingway-esque kind of telegraphic sentence. And what that meant was, as soon as I realized that and kind of rewrote the book with that kind of idea, it also, in many ways, changed the way the writing about the city was happening.
Now, you've introduced us to Rashid. Tell us about Dimple, because in some ways it's a love story, isn't it? Part of it is a love story between Rashid and a eunuch.
In fact, it is a love story. That's the point of the book. Characters are kind of based on people in some ways. And when you eventually write them, of course, they become something entirely different. But she was based on somebody I saw making pipes in an opium den in Shuklaji Street in, I think, 1979 or 80. And she was making pipes for this man who eventually was shot to death. He was a small-time gangster who owned an opium den and also dealt in cocaine, and he was shot to death, I think, 2 years later. And she was there for a very short period. I only saw her twice, but I never forgot her because in many ways Dimple, at least her appearance and some of the things she said, was based on that person.
So we meet her first making pipes for Rashid, and then she becomes his mistress, really, and she lives on the staircase below his wives and his the rest of his family. She also sorts his life out. She's a better businesswoman than he is.
Much better,
So she's sort of, in some way, she's the moral centre and the emotional centre of the novel.
She is, because she also goes through a kind of a transformation. She reads. That's what she does. And she reads anything she can find. And she develops into this character who eventually, you know, she has another name as well. And later on in the book, she's a man. She runs a rehab center. She talks about music and movies and books. And that's not actually a far-fetched idea. It's not entirely fictional. You know, there are people who do educate themselves and do transform themselves. And in a way, I thought picking a eunuch for that, it's a it is a literary device, but it's tremendously helpful to have a character who is both man and woman, who is Hindu and Christian and Muslim when she wants to be, who is who can be intellectual and at the same time absolutely emotional, and who can be a businesswoman as well as an addict.
And she reflects one of the themes in the book, which is the increasing Islamicization of the society. She dons a burqa at a certain point in the novel.
Yes.
And therefore, she has her Hindu self, which she still wears her saris sometimes, and then she also wears a burqa.
Well, yes, she also wears a burqa, and she sometimes wears a dress and goes to church. You know, and she, because her mother worshipped Christian gods, and Jesus and Mary specifically, had a little shrine at the bottom shelf of her closet, which she hid from her husband. And Dimple saw this, and eventually when she becomes an adult, she walks into church one day and she sees a life-size statue of Christ and imagines that he tells her, "I am alone like you." And this moves her tremendously. When she wears the burqa, it's because it allows her to travel freely in Bombay. Because it's true that if a woman wears a burqa in most Indian cities, she's untouchable in a way. Nobody will molest her. Nobody will even speak to her. It's a garment that demands a kind of respect that the sari perhaps does not. So she uses these religious identities to satisfy different parts of herself.
Now there is another narrator who is technically the narrator who's called Dom, who's an unsatisfied worker in a pharmaceutical company. It's a very strange narrative because it's sort of, one would almost say it's unreliable. The world sort of wiggles and wavers with depending on how tanked up the narrator is and the characters he's observing are.
Also, I think he's the least developed character in the novel because he's, in many ways, at least for the author, he was the least interesting because he's middle class. He has these literary pretensions. He has a job. He speaks English. He's ordinary. And he's really there just to open the book, to start it. He appears in the middle to move things along.
And then he takes her off.
He takes
Dimple off at the end, which I was very glad to.
Very crucial.
This novel has been compared very grandly and widely to people like Burroughs and De Quincey and Irving Welsh. But one thing that really struck me, I just happened to have been rereading Lawrence Durrell recently. It's got a very Durrellian sort of flavour to it, the way that you observe place through the wrong end of a telescope or the wrong end of a hooker in this case. Yeah. Are you offended by that? You know, that's a 1970s writer.
No, not at all. In fact, I'm grateful. I have read him and admired him when I was a boy. I read The Quartet. And I think when you read those four books when you're young, you internalize the language. And I think it's possible that did happen. And I see exactly what you mean. There's a kind of a blurring, a deliberate kind of imprecision that occurs in descriptions of the city in this book that could be termed Durrellian.
You've talked about your own time as an addict. One of the things you've said in an interview with The Hindu was that you wasted 20 years, and the suggestion was that lots of Bombay poets do that because you are a published poet before you were a novelist.
I don't think the Bombay poets were into drugs. Alcohol was the thing that really destroyed many Bombay poets. And there's something about that particular generation of poets in Bombay. There was a kind of honor in not publishing. So you would publish one book or two, and then there would be nothing for 20 years. The assumption was you'd be beavering away in your garret, but there would be nothing published. And there was, I'm not imagining this, there was a very clear kind of honor in that because there were so many poets who did that. And the great living Indian poet Adil Jasawala has just published a book after 35 years, one of the great Indian poets,
But you have published a book, and he has published a book, after all this time in the wilderness. I'm really interested in that, because most people wouldn't come back from it.
And many people didn't. And in fact, one reason I wrote this was to chronicle the small lives of the people who didn't come back, you know. And many, many people I knew did not make it. And that's the nature of the drug.
I think it was Amit Chowdhury said that poets in India are better than the novelists.
It's true. I completely agree, because with the novelists, you sometimes get the sense that they're writing for each other. And some of it seems derivative, and you feel like you've seen this before, and there's this kind of very soft focus, a romanticized, kind of idealized picture of India that's painted in some of these novels, which for anyone who's lived in India, it's completely untrue. You know, there's nothing soft focus about India. It's a brutal, difficult, maddening place daily, every day. It's a huge thing to live there and to, you know, continue to do whatever it is you're doing. Whereas the poets never did. They said it like it was. They put it all in there, you know. Indian poets were doing things with the language, with their subject matter, decades before the novelists began to even think about that.
There's a flirtation in this novel with certain literary tropes, including magic realism. So, for example, you have Dimple's drug reveries, where she sees a dead Chinaman swimming towards her. And I wondered whether that was partly the poet in you writing those.
I was thrilled, actually, when I realized that this is a book about intoxication. What that means is you can really go anywhere. You can be as insane as you might possibly want. So it was a liberating kind of device.
You didn't think of that as sort of knowingly, archly referring to the writing of, say, Rushdie.
For somebody from my generation, it's not easy to not have imbibed something of his influence, because it did change Indian writing in many ways. And besides, why would you want to shrug off that influence? I think it's a positive one.
Jeet Thayil's Narcopolis is published by Faber. Let's stay with drugs and their place in literature. It just so happens that opium is a pet subject for Phil Baker in work he's doing, both about opium dens in London and the power of the drug more widely. Phil, just going back to Narcopolis for 1 minute before we start on the wider subject. You read it. What did you think of it?
I liked it. I very much liked the rather lush style. I wasn't always convinced by some of the content, but the style, certainly, it's a very poetic style. And it had a kind of, I don't know what you'd say, a sort of iridescence in decay. He seemed to enjoy squalor. A couple of bits about smoking opium didn't strike me as completely convincing. I think there was something about a richly carved teak opium pipe. And that's the idea of a teak opium pipe is so odd. It's like a mahogany frying pan. I just don't think they exist.
Now, Jeet writes about the shift from opium to heroin. In the montage at the start of the podcast, we heard from Aldous Huxley, who famously experimented with the mind-expanding properties of mescaline and LSD, and from Edward St. Aubyn, whose autobiographical second novel deals with the effects of heroin addiction. So do drugs ever foster good writing? And do different drugs foster different sorts of writing, Phil?
I don't know if they foster good writing in people who weren't good writers in the first place. But certainly the collision between writers and drugs has been good sometimes. Thomas De Quincey, obviously, is a tremendous writer. William Burroughs, at best, is a tremendous writer. Yes. I've come to think, actually, that drug writing is a bit like a species of travel writing. So, and some people have a sort of knack for that kind of travel, I think.
So give us, what other writers are there? I mean, if you think about The Naked Lunch, for example, with the William Burroughs novel, it's a bit of a car crash in some ways, isn't it? But that's the point of it.
I suppose it's a mess. It's meant to be a mess. And it comes really out of the process of disintoxication. And it was cobbled together to some extent by friends who helped him edit this enormous manuscript, which was a bit chaotic. But it's something about Burroughs' sensibility that comes across in the book, I think. It isn't just produced by drugs, obviously.
Now, also with us in the studio, Sarah Crown, editor of the book's website.
Hi.
Sarah, there are several different issues that arise from this, and I'd like to separate them out. Writers who write under the influence, let's start with that.
Yeah, I suppose the writers that I know best who write under the influence would be poets, whether you're talking about the Beats or the Romantics. Coleridge is probably the example who's best known. He was troubled by many illnesses during his lifetime, probably due to a bout of rheumatic fever that he had as a child. And as a result of that, he was treated with laudanum, which was the kind of go-to drug of the day. And as a result of that, he developed this lifelong addiction to opium. And he himself was very clear about the fact that opium had an effect on his writing. He said that Kubla Khan arose out of a kind of reverie, he called it, which was induced by taking opium. And Christabel as well, his long poem, also came out of that. And they both have that sort of jeweled wooziness to them, which seems to be kind of characteristic of that kind of writing. But he wasn't the only one. I mean, at the time, everyone was on it. Keats, Byron, probably Shelley. Apparently when Shelley was dating Mary Shelley, he would carry a flask of laudanum in his pocket to calm his nerves, I thought was very sweet. And I think that what it arguably sort of fostered in them was this apprehension of the sublime, which kind of marks romantic poetry.
Phil, the sublime. Do you buy that?
Yes, I think so. Yeah, I think opiates will give people a sense of the sublime and a sense of being on the edge of some kind of great revelation, combined with a rather luxurious sense, which obviously suits people like Keats, whose whole aesthetic is quite kind of luxurious.
And just to bring us back to the basic, the proper meaning of sublime, it's not all about sublimely beautiful. It's also sublimely terrifying.
It's awesome. Yes, it's something awesome, really, as we might say, and something that colloquially you can't get your head round. Something that's just a bit too big to really understand, like looking into a starry sky.
Let's move on to the second point, which is writers who write about intoxication from a position of sobriety. I mean, Edward St. Aubyn writes from recollection.
I think a good example of this would probably be Melvyn Burgess's book Junk, which actually won the Guardian Children's Fiction Prize, I think.
It's rather shocking, that, isn't it? That predict could never have happened in my time.
And that is the story of two teenagers who go out of the squat and end up becoming addicted to heroin. And Irvine Welsh obviously did something similar with Trainspotting, and these were both late 90s. They're sort of setting out the effects of drugs rather than experiencing the effects and you know, kind of reproducing them, I guess.
Yeah. Phil, when Trainspotting was published, people were saying, oh, it's a revelation in the way that it wrote about the urban modern experience of taking drugs.
Maybe it needs to be deglamorised again for each generation. So maybe Irvine Welsh deglamorised it for his generation. Because there had always been people who wrote about drugs in quite a down-to-earth sort of way, like Alexander Trockey, for example. He was a friend of William Burroughs and a junkie himself, and he writes quite a realistic, quite down-market account of being addicted to heroin. I had a little boat, and he just lived on that quietly, read books and took heroin.
Going on to the third point, which is the point about what it does to form, we've sort of touched on it, but this is presumably very much part of what you've been thinking about, Phil, when you've been writing about... Well, you've written particularly about absinthe.
I think absinthe had the effect just of heavy drinking of alcohol, of making people rather paranoid. Toulouse-Lautrec thought he was being followed by the police and followed also by a headless dog.
Tell us more about opium, which is what you're studying at the moment.
Yeah, I think in De Quincey's case, it feeds into this tremendous sense of the sublime, as you were saying, experiences you can't quite encompass. But also he brought to it a kind of orientalist expectation, which then came out in his experience of the drug. So it's really with De Quincey that it turns into a kind of fantastic orient of the mind, a kind of China come Egypt. He says, I was worshipped, I was sacrificed. I'd done a deed, they said, that the ibis and the crocodile trembled at. So it takes on this very kind of grandiose, overblown quality for him. Mm-hmm. And it's really with him that it becomes exotic, because people like Dr. Johnson had been heavy opium users or heavy laudanum users, had no exotic expectations of it. And so that wasn't their experience of it. And through the 19th century, almost everybody was taking it. All the romantics, apart from Wordsworth, I think. Gladstone used to take opium before he gave speeches in Parliament. Florence Nightingale was a heavy user. Everybody was taking it. But it was really with De Quincey that this strange exoticism comes in, really through his writing.
And it's interesting that Thayil has gone back to that exoticism, hasn't he?
Yes, it is very much that kind of slumming sense of the opium den as something, a kind of locus of exoticism and also sort of vice and degradation, yes.
Sarah, what is the interest of this writing? Isn't it, we could say that these are just not interesting states.
Well, I think the interest comes from the difficulty of capturing that experience, because it is definitively a lived experience. I guess it's like writing about sex. It's bodily, it's physical, and it takes a real art, I think, to translate that into literature that then people can read and recognise, particularly if you're often talking to people who won't have had the same experience as you. I need somebody to conjure it for me, and that's a really difficult thing to do.
So, Phil, how much do you think drug-induced writing overlaps with other sorts of formal tropes, such as surrealism or expressionism?
I think there probably is an overlap with surrealism, and I suppose the common denominator is valuing the irrational. Maybe drugs are a kind of shortcut to the irrational, and it may be that surrealists show that you can do it without drugs. I don't know. And then there are people like Kafka, I suppose. I mean, the experience of waking up as a giant beetle, you feel that's probably the kind of thing that could have happened to De Quincey on a bad day. So there is, I think it's about exploring the irrational and valuing the irrational. I think that's probably the common
denominator. And finding the image for a state of mind.
Being able to express it, yes. Somehow drug writers, maybe all writers, I think they particularly express it in terms of place. And maybe you get that with some of the surrealists, particularly de Chirico, for example, expresses states of mind in terms of places. And in his novel, Hebdomeros, it's very much about these places, which are a bit like the places that people reach through drug experiences. Certainly Burroughs was a great traveller. There's a kind of topography of states of mind in Burroughs, places he gets to.
Well, thank you both very much. And Phil, tell us when we can expect your next oeuvre.
I'm hoping to do something on Sax Rohmer and Dr. Fu Manchu, the fiendish Chinese mastermind, probably for the anniversary of the first Fu Manchu book next year, 2013.
Well, we'll look forward to that. So you don't have to be on drugs or boozed up to want to go beyond simple naturalism in your writing. It can also be a reaction to the harshness of reality. Not just Kafka, but think of all those other Eastern European allegorists. A fine contemporary surrealist has emerged in the writer Edgar Keret. He's an Israeli who works in film and television, but periodically jumps out with a book, such as his latest, very striking short story collection, Suddenly a Knock on the Door. He read to Richard Lee.
Guava. There was no sound from the engines of the plane. There were no sounds at all, except perhaps the soft crying of the air stewardesses a few rows behind him. Through the elliptical window, Shkedi looked at the cloud hovering just below him. He could imagine the plane dropping through it like a stone, punching an enormous hole that would be sealed again quickly with the first breeze, leaving not so much as a scar. "Just don't crash," Shkedi said. "Just don't crash." 40 seconds before Shkedi expired, an angel appeared, all dressed in white, and told him he'd been awarded a last wish. Shkedi tried to find out what awarded implied. Was it an award like winning the lottery, or was it something a bit more flattering, awarded in the sense of an achievement in recognition of his good deeds? The angel shrugged. "Don't know," he said with a pure angelic sincerity. "They told me to come and fulfill on the double. They didn't say why." "That's a shame," Shkedi said, "because it's absolutely fascinating, especially now when I'm about to leave this world and everything. I'd really like to know if I'm living it just as another lucky guy or if I'm living it with a pat on the back." 40 seconds and you kick off," the angel droned. "If you want to spend those 40 seconds yapping, that's fine with me, no problem. Just consider that your window of opportunity is about to close." Shkedi considered and quickly made his wish, but not before taking the trouble to point out to the angel that he had a strange way of talking. For an angel, that is. The angel was hurt. "What do you mean for an angel? Have you ever heard an angel talk before? That you dump a thing like that on me?" Suddenly the angel looked much less angelic and much less pleasant, but that was nothing compared to what he looked like after he heard the wish. "Peace on earth?" he screamed. "Peace on earth? You're kidding me." And then Shkedi died. Shkedi's soul completely forgot it had ever belonged to a person called Shkedi, and was reincarnated, pure and untainted, second-hand but good as new, as a piece of fruit, a guava. Guavas don't have thoughts, but it had feelings. It felt an overwhelming fear. It was afraid of falling off the tree. Not that it had the words to describe this fear, but if it had, it would have been something like, "Oh my God, And while it was hanging there on the tree, petrified, peace began to reign on Earth. People beat their swords into plowshares, and nuclear reactors soon began to be used for peaceful purposes. But none of this was of any comfort to the guava, because the tree was tall, and the ground seemed distant and painful. "Just don't let me drop," the guava shuddered wordlessly. "Just don't crash."
Fantastic. So I want to ask, why the short story? Why not a novel?
I never kind of intended to write short stories. I think that every time I sit down and start writing, I'm sure that I'm going to write this kind of trilogy, you know, and I get attached to my character and imagine his grandchildren sitting with him in the yard. And then like 2 pages later, a bus hits him and he dies. And I say, whoa, you know, and the story ends.
What happened there?
You know, everybody, like my publisher, my agent, my wife, they all want me to write a novel, and I have nothing to do against it. It just, I said to them, I cannot sit down and write a novel. I write a story, you know.
Are you a planner? Do you sit down with like bits of paper and sort it out, or you just start in there?
I never plan. And the only way I know to do that is basically to kind of lose control over the story. If you kind of try to tame the story, to keep to a certain plot, to do certain things, then it would never be smarter than you, you know? So I think it's good for geniuses to write this way, but for me, I must let give the story a chance to surprise me.
Do you make a division between the stories that are kind of realistic and the stories that have these fantastical elements, the talking fish, the angels appearing and so on?
I don't make this differentiation, you know. I usually differentiate them by some sort of a tone, you know. Some stories kind of feel more optimistic, or some of them feel more aggressive, you know, some of them feel more attentive. But the ontological facts, you know, I don't care much for them. You know, I know that when I met my wife and we kissed, I felt I was levitating. And if somebody would physically prove to me that I wasn't, in my story, I would still levitate, you know. So when you write a story, I think that you usually write from a subjective point of view. And this subjective point of view creates a certain ontology. And if this ontology works, then I don't care if you bring a scientist that will say that goldfish can't speak in Russian.
It kind of makes sense in the story. It makes sense for the characters in the story.
For me, what's important is to be sincere and consistent. You know, what's going outside in the world, outside the pages of my story, doesn't interest me when I write a story.
You said before that writing for you is a kind of way of almost kind of disengaging with reality.
I live in an extremely weird world. I don't know in which kind of world do you live, but especially in the region I come from, you know, in the Middle East, the world around me is totally, it goes from bizarre to quirky to just plain arbitrary and doesn't make sense. So the fact that, let's say, a news commentator says it in a very serious voice doesn't make it any less quirky. When I write my stories, I many times think that my stories makes much more sense than the reality around me, because usually things are justified, you know, emotionally. And I can't say the same for many of the people who share a region with me.
They seem to accept the strangeness as if it's kind of natural quite a lot, as if it's kind of fine. You don't find people saying, oh my God, there's an angel happening. They just kind of get on with it.
When I was a kid, both my parents are Holocaust survivors, and they would tell me bedtime stories. And for them, it was kind of mandatory not to read from books, because being children of war, their parents always told them their stories orally when they were in hiding. So my mother would tell me all those stories about fairies, magical creature, and talking goldfish and stuff. And my father, all his stories always took place in a whorehouse. And the heroes were always like prostitutes and drunk people. The most optimistic and positive and beautiful stories one could ever imagine.
This is when you were what kind of age? You were
5.
5, yeah.
And the whole idea about it was that my father, after surviving the war, he wanted to fight you British people. So he joined what was called the Irgun. It was like an underground for the British people. And he was asked to find weapons for them. So he went around Europe and then finally got to Italy and kind of befriended some mafia guys. And he started kind of buying weapons from them. And those people saw that at night he would sleep in a park because he didn't have any money. They say, you know, we have a whorehouse. You can sleep in our whorehouse for free. And basically, everything in life is relative. So after the war and Nazis killing his sister and, you know, and him hiding in a hole in the ground for 600 days, those mafia guys seemed very kind. As he always used to say to me, you could always see how unhappy they were when they had to kill someone. Which for him, like, he didn't see before people who were unhappy when they... He actually saw people who were very happy to kill him and his family. So he would tell me all those stories. And I think that for me, this was something that affected my writing tremendously. Kind of not being judgmental about anything. Because, you know, when I was a kid, I didn't know what a prostitute meant and what a drunk really meant, you know. But I knew that when I grew up, I want to be a drunk prostitute because it sounded fun in these stories.
There's another thread which runs through quite a lot of them, which is kind of fiction about the business of making fiction.
Quite a few of the stories in this collection deal with the fact that why the hell is it so important for me to write? Because I think this book almost have some sort of an Arabian Nights structure in which kind of telling a story is the only way you can keep surviving. Telling a story or writing fiction helps you kind of make sense out of some sort of an arbitrary reality around you. You know, it's like many times I have this urge. I want to call my wife and say to her, take the kid and get out of the house. Do it now. Like they do in the movies, you know. But I really don't want people kind of to explode my house, you know, in the next scene, you know. So writing a story gives you this benefit. Like, you can do things without dealing with the consequences. It's like my wife said to me that in these collections, she said there's so many stories about married people cheating on their wives. And I said, what would you prefer, you know, that I have stories about loyal husbands and that I cheat on you? You know, I write the stories for me to read them. And after that, if somebody else wants to read them, like, good for him, you know. But if he doesn't understand it, then I'm sorry, you know. Don't read stories written by strangers next time, you know.
What are you gonna do, Mark? You're out of your mind. The outer, the inner mind. Become the inner and the outer mind. The outer, inner mind.
Edgar Carrot there talking to Richard Lee. Suddenly a Knock at the Door is published by Chatto in the UK and FSG in the US. And that's all we have time for this week. If you have any thoughts about any of the subjects we've talked about, please do join the discussion in the comments thread beneath this podcast at guardian.co.uk/books. We'd also love to hear from you if there are any writers or issues you'd like us to podcast about in future. And if this is your first time listening to us, why not become a regular subscriber? Same place or via iTunes. As well as our regular weekly edition, we have lots of occasional treats. On Monday, we visit the writer Carol Phillips in A Room for London, the boat in the shape of Joseph Conrad's Roi des Belges, which is spending the London Olympic year on top of the South Bank Centre. Sarah's still here to tell us about all the other things we have to look forward to in the coming week.
Actually, first of all, I want to talk about another occasional treat which happened yesterday. If you missed it, we did a podcast special interview with Jane Rogers, the winner of this year's Arthur C. Clarke Award. So that's still there if you want to go back and listen. Next week, we'll be paying a visit to the British Library to find out about their latest exhibition, Writing Britain. And you can find out more about that this weekend from Blake Morrison, who's writing in the Saturday Review. And Sunday's Observer this week has a spring fiction special with reviews of the new John Irving, the new Mark Haddon, and many more. And we'll be rolling those reviews out on the book's website over the weekend.
Thanks, Sarah. And thanks also to our producer, Tim Mabey. You'd be quite surprised at how many of the strange reading voices come from him. Thanks also to our chief reader and rep actor, Chris Moran. Also to Jeet Thayil, Edgar Carrot, and Phil Baker. I'm Claire Armistead. Goodbye.
Don't forget to start your free 14-day trial of audible.co.uk and to download your free audiobook. Head to guardian.co.uk/audible. For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.